After a minute, she said, "Well, I never made you that sandwich." But she sat down at the table across from him. He met her eyes. "You sure have been thinking about this?" She heard her voice break. He said, "I have to believe I wouldn't die of it, for the child's sake, and for yours, if you ever wanted to come back. But I do feel that a child should have a living father, if the old codger can manage it. Someone to fall back on, as long as possible." He shrugged. "I think through things. It calms me. Otherwise, I don't react as well as I could have, as I would have wanted to." They'd been married a year, no, almost a year and a half, and he was still just as lonely as ever, and that scared her. So she said, "It's nice you think some man somewhere is going to bother to come looking for me. No chance of that happening, Reverend. You got me all to yourself, if that's what you want." He said, "I guess I want it too much to believe I have it." She said, "I feel the same way, pretty much." He nodded. "That's good to know. I never thought I'd be living in a house like this, that's for sure. I mean, a house where I was the wife and anybody cared if I stayed or left." He nodded. "I hope sometime you'll feel a little more at home, Lila. I hope sometime you'll move things around a little in here. These old pictures my mother put up, I probably haven't looked at some of them in 50 years. Most of them she just cut out from magazines. Well, you can see that, the way they've faded. My grandfather made the frames for them. I think it was mainly a way she had of keeping him out of her kitchen. He always wanted to be doing something. My point is that things don't have to stay the way they are if you want to change them." She said, "You ever heard of a credenza?" He laughed. "A credenza? I've seen the word somewhere, I suppose. I'm not quite sure I know what one is." "Well, I'm glad if you don't." He nodded, happy to oblige. "That's one thing I don't ever want around here. It might be hard to find one in Iowa, so that's good." He said, "Because this is your house, Lila. No credenza will ever come under its roof. Now you're laughing at me. I've made a solemn promise. I gave you my word. I've never been more serious." He was at the cupboard, rummaging. "Sometimes I just laugh because I'm surprised. But I better have a little lunch. I get cranky on an empty stomach. Can't risk disheartening some poor sinner. You never know when one might wander in. Just a peanut butter and jelly sandwich will make me worthier of my calling. Till supper, anyway."
"I was going to do that. Then we got talking. I'm glad we got talking. I'm always glad when we talk. I have so much to learn.
Here I could have wandered in some day with a credenza, meaning no harm." Then he looked at her. "I'm sorry."
"It don't matter." She had put her hands to her face. "I was just thinking."
He stood looking at her. "Well, why don't you come down to the church with me? It's quiet today. Some people are coming from Des Moines to talk with me about a funeral. I didn't really know the fellow. He just happened to die here, and I have to have something to say about him. But you could wait for me in the sanctuary. Do your thinking there."
She shook her head. "It ain't that kind of thinking," she said. "It's on my mind now, so I might as well get it done with. It's so different here, it makes me remember other places I've been. I guess I have to do that, sort things out a little. Seems like I don't even know myself, everything's so different."
"Yes. Well, as soon as I can get away, I'll be home. Unless you want the afternoon to yourself."
"I'll come to find you, like I always do."
"All right." He kissed her forehead. 5 o'clock, then."
It came over her, before he had even closed the door behind him, the thought of that house in St. Louis. It was just pure misery. Misery must have been what she was looking for, because she felt it the minute she walked in that door. The twilight of the parlor made her feel as if she had stepped into deep water with her eyes open. Breathing came hard and sound reached her a heartbeat after she should have heard it. She could hardly speak. Nothing was the way it was in daylight, but the place had its own ways and you got used to them. Like death, if something comes after it. That first day, there were girls fighting over a hairbrush. Mrs. got up from her chair and went and took the brush away from them and put it in the credenza. When they saw her coming, they shrank away from her, watching her.
"Now," she said when she came back to Lila, "you get a safe place to live, so long as you act right. Any trouble and you're gone. I don't like drinking or yelling. I don't want you out on the street. This is a respectable house. Quiet. Our gentlemen like it that way.
She called them gentlemen, and the girls were supposed to be ladies. But they were always fighting over something, a pair of shoes or a scrap of ribbon, and Mrs. would be slapping or pulling hair. The gentlemen brought in liquor, so they didn't have to steal it out of the cabinet unless they just wanted to. Mrs. went off sometimes to visit her sister and left the woman they called Peg in charge, and she'd let them drink if they let her boss them around a little. Then they'd fight over nothing at all and cry for their mothers and say they were going to leave that place and that life and never look back. And the gentlemen would say, "Sure you will, sugar, just not tonight." But they never opened the shades or stepped out the door, and they never touched the credenza. Then they were glad when Mrs. came back. She'd yell at them for their cheap carousing and say she was going to toss them all out. And she'd add what she said was the cost of the liquor to the amount of money she said they all owed her already, and they'd just be glad she was back anyway. And they'd be so quiet and so careful to mind her that she had to calm down sometime. They'd be begging her to let them brush out her hair. A few of them had lived there since they were almost children, one or two of them probably feeble-minded, and two or three of them were just like Lila, no better and no worse, all crowded into two rooms, sleeping on cots so that the other rooms stayed nice for entertaining. If one of them got sick, they'd all get sick, or say they were, and Mrs. would close every blind and turn off every light, so the gentlemen would know they couldn't have company, she said. But really, to make everything miserable enough to get back at them if they ever dared pretend. When a house is shut up like that in the middle of a summer day, the light that comes in through any crack is as sharp as a blade. And there would be a pot of potato soup simmering from morning to night, and the steam from it would bring out the tobacco smells and the sour old liquor smells in the rugs and the couches and the drapes. And she'd put the poker deck and the checkerboard in that damn credenza and anything else that could help the time pass. Not that they could have seen the spots on the cards, dark as it was. In a day or two, they'd start saying they were better, and could they open a window a crack? Just the darkness made some of them cry. Then, when she had turned on some lights and opened a window or two, and they had put the place to rights, she would open the credenza and pass out the things she had put in it, the darning egg and the harmonica, and they'd be happy to have them back, as if she had done them a kindness. That credenza was the shape of a coffin with little legs on it, and flowers of lighter-colored wood on the front of it, some of them peeling off, some of them gone, just the glue left. It was always locked. Any one of the girls could have figured a way to break into it, but they never did. One time, Mrs. found some letters that belonged to the girl they called Sal and locked them up for safekeeping, she said. That girl was begging for them until finally she just gave up. And that was when Mrs. got around to letting her have them back for a while. Lila had hidden her knife in a gap between boards in a closet floor. There were boxes stacked in that corner, and the knife was underneath them, so she thought it was safe. Mrs. had nothing that mattered to take from her. Nothing of hers to lock away. Lila was called Rosie because no one else was Rosie, and the pink dress fit her well enough. Sal and Tilly showed her how to tie up her hair in rags so it would curl. They rinsed it with henna first. Mrs. charged her a quarter for the henna and $5 for a pair of pink high-heeled shoes that were half worn out, but she'd never find any cheaper. She could pay a couple dollars a week for the dress. Buying it would put her too far in debt, but she could rent it. So she was $7.25 behind already, sitting there with her hair in rags and them about to punch holes in her ears with a darning needle. Then there was room and board, but that could wait till she made her start, Mrs. said. Once you're bringing in some regulars. Lila was just listening to all this, trying not to do the arithmetic. She should have walked out right then, but the other girls stayed there and put up with it, the damn credenza and the ugly gentleman and all of it. After a while, she was one of the older girls, and when a young one came to her all upset, she would say just what they all said, "Don't you come crying to me," and "What did you expect when you come here?" Then Lila would be patting the girl's hands or putting her hair in pin curls just to quiet her down. When they weren't working or fighting, they were usually setting each other's hair. That one day, Mrs. asked her,
"Do you have any little treasures you want to keep safe? Anything you want to give me?"
And Lila said,
"I got a knife. That's the only thing. I've been wanting to give you my knife."
The words were just there, and she said them, and she meant them, too.
"Bring it to me. Let me keep it for you, dear. We don't want a knife lying around the house."
So Lila went to the closet and found it still hidden there, and took it and handed it over, amazed as she did it, thinking, "This is it. I'm here now. This is the life I'm going to have." Mrs. just looked at it lying there in her hand like it was an ugly thing. So Lila said, "Somebody killed my father with it." And then, because she didn't want to lie to the woman, she said, "He might have been my father." Mrs. smiled a little. She said,
"I see."
And Lila watched her lock it away. Well, she's got me now. And what sense did that make? But she felt that way, and it gave her a kind of ease. Standing right there by the credenza, with the key still in her hand, Mrs. looked Lila over like she'd never seen her before and said,
"You ain't a pretty girl, but you might try smiling, Rosie."
"Yes, ma'am. Yes, I will."
Talking to her like that, calling her ma'am, it was a thing Lila blushed to remember, how much she was giving that woman. Doll's knife? But why shouldn't she stop being Lila Doll and take another made-up name and let herself be glad there was someone telling her what to do every minute, no matter if she hated it? She could smile if she had to. People smile. When she was trying on that pink dress, Mrs. had the girl Lucy come in and pick up the dress she'd been wearing and her shoes and leave her an old flannel nightgown. Lucy said,
"I guess you won't be going nowheres now."
Lila blushed to remember how hurt she was that Mrs. thought she might run off. She'd thought, "Now I gave her my knife. She's got it locked up. The one thing in the world I had that was mine." And she was glad that she'd given it up, that Mrs. didn't have to find it and take it from her the way she did that girl's letters. Lila had tried to think of anything else she could give her. As soon as she started earning a little money, "My locket." What was she thinking? It was the old man's locket. She didn't even have it yet when she lived in that house. But if she had, she blushed at the thought that she'd have asked for her help with the clasp, and that she'd have been glad to feel her lift it from her neck, to see it lying in that claw of a hand. She loved it that much. Lila said out loud, "You poor child. Your mother is a crazy woman." The dress they gave her to wear had net under the skirt of it, like tiny little chicken wire, and the top just covered what it had to, and the rest was bare. Then, those pink shoes she could hardly walk in. Peg would sing, "You're all dressed up to go dreaming," and laugh, which was a mean thing to do because some of them just loved that song. It was bare feet and a raggedy old nightgown, except when there were gentlemen. Mrs. never even looked at her. She treated her like she was nothing at all. Lila tried smiling. They'd be dressed up the best they could and dancing to the Victrola when the gentlemen started coming in, one uglier than the next, but all of them feeling rich because they could pay for an evening. There was one the girls were scared of because he was always drunk and mad and telling them he'd see to it that they all died in jail, telling them that he'd had his wallet stolen one time, and when he figured out who'd done it, he swore he would beat her within an inch of her life. Mrs. never made him go away. $10 meant that much to her. It was the other gentleman who put him out the door, if anybody did, because some of them liked a little talk. How could she tell the old man about things she didn't understand herself? First there was Doll saying, "I don't know you." And then there was that box with somebody in it that could have been her father, and all those cousins, or whatever they were, turning their backs on her, as if a bad joke had been played on them that she wasn't any more than she was. And then, looking for Doll everywhere, creeping down through cellar doors even, hoping she might be out of the weather, then walking out into the cornfields where a person could hide or be lost till the buzzards found them. There was one man they called Mac. He didn't have much of anything wrong with him, but he liked to come by, and the girls liked to have him there because he teased them and brought them chocolates, and they thought he looked like a man you might want around, even if he wasn't paying. He was always laughing or about to laugh, and it didn't matter if there was something a little mean about the way he did it. He was a working man, you could tell, but he knew some ballroom dancing, the waltz and the foxtrot, so they'd put the Victrola on and he'd dance with every one of them, even with Lila. The parlor wasn't big enough for more than three couples, but they'd push the chairs back and dance themselves winded. Sal once said, "This is what it's supposed to be like." They all loved Mac, but he favored one girl, the short, plump one they called Missy. After a while, he'd start up the stairs and she'd go tagging after him, because that's how it was. Lila was horribly in love with that man. You can't go on forever thinking about nothing at all. And he had a nice face and that laugh, and what harm was there in it, since she could hardly even bring herself to look at him? But he could tell somehow, and he started teasing her about it. "Rosie, Rosie, give me a smile," he would say, and she couldn't do that at all, because she just wanted to hide her face. "Rosie, give me a peck on the cheek, just a little one," making a joke of her, when he was the only thing she cared about in this world, and he seemed to know it. When just a few gentlemen came, Lila was always left sitting, and if Max saw her there, he'd say, "Rosie, here's the kind of girl a man could want to marry. There are good-time girls, and there are girls you'd want to take home." Missy would say, "Why, she's tough as a mule. I guess you might take her home if you needed some plowing done." And he'd say, "A man wants a girl the other fellas ain't gonna come hankering after." And she'd say, "Well, I guess that's old Rosie, all right. There's nobody comes hankering, that's for sure." But it made Missy jealous that he said those things. Once, she flew at Lila for nothing and pulled her hair all this way and that, so the pins fell out, and the other girls laughed as if it was something they'd been wanting to do themselves and hadn't gotten round to it yet. Lila never knew people could be so mean. She was mean, too, because the sadness in that house was like a dream that made everything strange and wrong. Mac could run his finger along her cheek, and she would feel the warmth rising to follow it. He would touch her neck sometimes, and it would make the tears come every single time he did it, no matter who else was watching. It was terrible, and it was mostly what she lived for. The other girls laughed at her, and they were jealous because he paid even that kind of attention to her. So she made a kind of plan. There was an old man who was supposed to come before sunrise to stoke the coal furnace. Sometimes he did, and sometimes he just wandered in when he felt like it. There was nothing any of them hated more than getting up to a cold house. Lila liked that kind of work a lot better than what she'd been doing, or trying to do. She owed Mrs. more money by the day, and she couldn't think of any other reason she was kept on except to make everybody else feel like they were better. She couldn't walk in those damn shoes, and she couldn't keep that look off her face. A couple of times, Mrs. slapped her for it, but that didn't help. Once, Mac touched her tears with the tip of his finger and then touched the wet to her lips. "She's a sweet girl, Missy. See that? Like a little child." She couldn't look at him. She couldn't even breathe. And there he was, watching her, smiling. So the next morning she went down cellar in her nightgown and bare feet, and stood there in the darkest dark with her back to the furnace for the warmth. If she stoked it too early, Mrs. would be after her for the coal she wasted, and if she waited too long, the old man might come to do it. If he did come, she decided she'd shake the shovel at him a little, and he'd probably run off the best he could, scrawny as he was. Mrs. had to pay him something, but Lila would be working off a debt. So Mrs. would see it was best to let her have her way. Then she'd scrub down the kitchen, which needed it something terrible. It was high time somebody beat those rugs. Just standing there in the dark felt so good to her. She'd get all black and filthy with the coal dust, and when she came upstairs, who knew what they would say? And that was all right, because she had this time to be quiet with herself. How long it had been! She was standing there, leaning against the warmth with her eyes closed, and she began to have bright dreams about waking up before dawn with Doll's arm for a pillow and the sound of a fire, and Doan talking with whoever else was awake first. It was always Doan who got the fire going, and then Arthur would start the coffee when they had it, and Doll coaxed her awake. They would fry whatever there was, the light coming up and the birds singing. Dew on everything. Beat it on cobwebs so it fell like a little rain when you broke one. Then Dahl looked at her and said, "You're standing in a coal hole." No, Lila must have said that. She'd started talking to herself, and they teased her about it. She knew nothing about anything but field work and making change, and housekeeping from the time in Tammany. When she lived in that town where they didn't hang Dahl, and she worked in the store, sometimes she would walk out at night, because then you can see into people's houses. The accounts always came out just right when she was working there, never a penny short. She was saving up a little money. There was nothing wrong with working indoors when a place was as clean as that and smelled so good. Ham and coffee and cheese and apples and flour, spools of ribbon and bolts of pretty cloth. She'd watch how the women were dressed and what they did with their hair, listen to the way they talked. She'd really wanted to know those things. Well, she'd been learning some things lately, that's for sure. "You're standing there in the dark in a filthy old cellar. I like it down here." That was her talking to herself again. "I ain't cut out for this life," Dahl said. "I tried to tell you about it. Didn't I tell you?" "No, you didn't. Just to stay away from whorehouses. Just that you got that scar. Anyway, I had a decent job, and then you come bleeding all over everything, fouling the place." She nodded. "I should have given that more thought. But where's my knife? Why you let that woman have my knife? It's the only thing I had to give her." "That don't make sense." Lila was the one who said that. But Dahl would have said it. If Lila had had the knife and a gold watch and chain, she'd have handed them all to that woman, seen them lying there in her hand, and wished there was something else to give her. It was a bitter sorrow to her that Mrs. hardly even bothered with her anymore, never smeared rouge on her face or told her she might try smiling. "The gentlemen come here for a good time. You look at them like you hate them." She hated them, for a fact. They were the worst part of the whole damn situation. It was them that made her think sometimes she'd like to have that knife back. No, because she couldn't go anywhere so long as it was locked away. Safe keeping. There was a picture in there of Peg's sister, and Mrs. only let her look at it once in a while. She'd say, "Peg, I was going to let you look at that photo, but the way you've been acting lately." Then there would be "please," and "I'm sorry," and "I won't do it again if you just tell me what it was I done." And Mrs. would say, "Like you don't know. Next time I'll just toss it in the fire." Begging only worked sometimes. Not quite never, but they did it anyway, till she slapped them for it. Lila said, "I never knew there was such a place." And Dahl said, "Didn't I warn you?" "No, you didn't. But I guess you must have told me something. How else did I know to come here, to just purely hate my life, hate everything about it? My damn body, my damn face, the damn misery in my heart, because I got nothing to care about. How did that Mac get in there to devil me the way he does, when I never meant him one bit of harm?" She thought, if I could hate him too, that would make things easier. Nothing was supposed to be easier, she knew that. Once, when Mrs. was gone, somebody left a door unlocked and a preacher got in. He said a word or two about hell before they pushed him back out. She'd heard about it before anyway at a camp meeting. Maybe that's how she knew to come here, thinking it might be where she belonged. But it was taking so long, worse every day because it was the same every day. It wasn't the end of anything. And she was beginning to think now and then about sunshine and the smell of the air, trees. She thought, I'm just doing that to devil myself. Well, she better start shoveling the coal. She was only used to a wood fire, so she'd have to be careful not to put too much in too fast. Stir the coals and then build up the fire so she could see what she was doing. She knew a boiler could burst if something happened. It got too hot or heated up too fast. Then the coals would fly everywhere and the whole damn house would burn down, probably. She could fill it up, leaving just enough room for her to crawl in after and close the door. Boom! She'd go flying, a flaming piece of her right into that girl's face, that Peg, and another one into Rita's lap, where she was always picking at her fingernails until they were bloody, and another one into the room where they kept the dress-up clothes when the gentlemen weren't around. And Mac would see her, all fire like that, and he'd probably be laughing, thinking he'd done it. He'd touch her cheek, and the fire would come away on his hand, and he'd probably just lick it off. He'd say, "Now that's the kind of girl a man would marry," telling that damn lie again, just to see if she could burn any hotter than fire.